Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the new EAN episode. I'm Alberto Vogridge, and I'm Assistant Professor of Neurology at the University of Udine, Italy. And it's a pleasure for me to introduce the theme of the day, which is a clinical approach of neurological symptoms in patients with cancer. And it's a part of the overarching theme of the November issue of the EAN podcast, which is, as you know, neuro-oncology. So it is indeed an honor for me to introduce our speaker, who is Giulia Berzero, who is Assistant Professor of Neurology at the University Vita Salute San Raffaele in Milan, Italy, and works in the Department of Neurology, directed by Professor Massimo Filippi. She's a former research fellow of the Neuro-Oncology Department of Pitié Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, where she studied molecular neuro-oncology, paraneoplastic neurological syndromes, as well as neurological complication of cancer treatment under the guidance of Professor Marc Sanson and Professor Delatre. So I think really she's the best person to tackle this topic. And so I start with the first question on my side, which is the problem of the burden of neurological issues in patients with systemic cancer. So, Giulia, can you tell us how often do cancer patients develop neurological symptoms, please?
Yeah, thank you, Alberto. Thank you for having me in this podcast. So over the last decade, the survival of cancer patients has dramatically improved thanks to novel treatments that are increasingly becoming available. For example, the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors for metastatic melanoma or the use of CAR T cells for refractory B cell lymphomas has radically changed the prognosis associated with these disorders. When living longer, cancer patients are more likely to develop neurological symptoms during life. And neurological dysfunction can be related to a number of reasons, for example, to the cancer itself, to intervening condition, or to the toxic effects of some anti-cancer treatments. Immune checkpoint inhibitors and CAR T cell, for example, are associated with specific neurological toxicities that, as neurologists, we have been learning to diagnose and treat. Well, this observation emphasizes the importance for neurologists to keep updated on novel oncological therapies and establish continuous collaborations with local oncology departments.
Yeah, so this is very interesting because you say that with the increased survival of patients with cancer, we are going to probably see more neurological symptoms, neurological complication. So this is, this podcast can timely, I would say. And I have this question. Are all cancer patients equally at risk of developing a neurological complication, or there are some differences?
Well, indeed, there are some differences. Well, not all cancer patients have the same likelihood to develop neurological symptoms. For example, there are patient-related factors such as age, and presence of systemic comorbidities. And there are also tumor-related factors such as cancer type, stage, and treatment that influence the risk of developing neurological symptoms. For example, patients with cancers that are prone to disseminate to the CNS are at risk of presenting brain metastases or neoplastic meningitis, while patients receiving cancer treatments that have neurotoxic potential are more vulnerable to drug-induced toxicity. So each patient, based on their specific clinical characteristics, has a different risk of developing neurological complications while being treated for cancer.
So a lot of neurologists in practice, or neurospecialists, but also university neurologists and neurologists in training are probably listening to this podcast. So it is really important if you can give us some clues on how to approach a patient with cancer developing neurological symptoms.
Well, as it often happens in neurology, Neurological examination and patient history are the backbone of the clinical approach to these patients. So neurological examination is very important since it allows to define the structures of the nervous systems that are involved and enables to grasp some specific or even pathognomonic clinical signs that can be present while visiting the patient. But also information on tumor type, stage, prior and ongoing anti-cancer medications may help to hypothesize the cause for this neurological dysfunction and help the clinician to plan the adequate paraclinical assessment to confirm his or her hypothesis.
Yeah, this is an important message that you gave us. By starting with the direct invasion of the central nervous system by cancer, can you tell us how common are brain metastases and which are the tumor types that more frequently disseminate to the brain?
Yes, well, it is estimated that about one patient out of five will develop brain metastases while being treated for cancer. Brain metastases generally present as multiple lesions within the brain parenchyma, and they are usually located at the cortical-subcortical junction, either in the cerebral hemispheres or in the cerebellum. More rarely, we observe neoplastic meningitis, which is a condition resulting from tumor cells seeding along the leptomeninges. Due to their biological features and their prevalence in the general population, lung and breast cancer are the tumors that are primarily responsible for brain metastases. Other tumor types that commonly disseminate to the brain include, for example, melanoma, colorectal, and kidney cancer. But it's not only the tumor type that determines the risk to develop a brain metastasis, it is also the molecular profile of the tumor. For example, among lung and breast cancer, we have ALK rearranged non-small cell lung cancer and EGR2 positive breast cancer that are the subtype that are most likely to disseminate to the brain. The risk of brain metastasis also depends on cancer stage. The more advanced is the primary tumor, the more likely is brain dissemination because of a mechanism of hematogenous spread.
So thank you very much. Regarding CNS dissemination, I think that it's very important to give also a practical message in this aspect. If you can describe us, when should we suspect CNS dissemination and which assessment, which test would you recommend to perform in this setting?
Well, there are some clinical presentation that may prompt to suspect brain metastasis right away. For example, a patient presenting with subacute focal deficits, partial seizure, or intracranial hypertension should immediately be suspected to have brain metastasis. In a patient like this, for example, one could be prompted to perform a contrast CT scan, which is acceptable as initial test, but contrast brain MRI should immediately follow since MRI enables to detect even very, very small metastatic lesion and thus should be preferred to the CT. If the lesions we find on MRI are typical to be brain metastasis and the primary tumor is known to have a high risk for CNS dissemination, there is no need to perform, for example, a biopsy or surgery just to confirm histology, and the patient can proceed directly to the treatment of the brain mets. More complex is the case of neoplastic meningitis, which can present with much more insidious symptoms, such as headache, backache, nausea, vomiting, or, for example, cranial nerve involvement. Well, in this setting, for example, contrast MRI should involve both the brain and the spine to explore all potential sites of meningeal involvement. But since MRI and CSF cytology can be negative in patients with neoplastic meningitis, at least at first, these assessments should be repeated during follow-up to reach a definite diagnosis if this is needed.
Yeah, thank you. I think that there is probably an underdiagnosis of CNS meningeal involvement of cancer. And if I may add, also the reduced CSF glucose should alert the physician of a process that could be, let's say, meningeal involvement of cancer or CNS infection. So really, it's an important parameter to consider. And beside the CNS dissemination, which are the most relevant differential diagnosis in your opinion?
Well, CNS dissemination, it is true that is often the main concern when a cancer patient develops neurological symptoms. However, there is a very long list of differential diagnoses. For example, we have metabolic encephalopathies and vitamin deficiencies, which can be common in elderly patients who have systemic comorbidities. Some patients are exposed to a high risk of CNS infection, especially those patients who have a very intense and prolonged immune suppression. Subgroups of patients are at risk of stroke. For example, if they have a cancer-related coagulopathy, if they have received the radiation over the brain, while other patients, because of the type of the tumor, might be predisposed to have paraneoplastic neurological symptoms. Well, to this list, which is already quite long, we should add specific neurological toxicities associated with cancer treatments, for example, with chemotherapy, with targeted agents, immunotherapies, and radiotherapy. And each of these toxicities has a distinctive clinical phenotype. So all these possible causes of neurological impairment account for the great complexity of differential diagnosis in patients with cancer and underscores really the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to this type of patients.
So you really provide us a very nice overview of the possible etiologies and how to think about these different conditions. So some of these etiologies will be covered extensively in other editions of the podcast, but it's really important, I think, for us to have a complete overview such as the one that you very nicely provided. And regarding this complex diagnosis, I would like to ask you, how can we improve the care of patients with cancer developing neurological complications?
Well, the key to achieve an optimal diagnosis and management of this condition is probably a close collaboration between all the different actors that are responsible for the care of cancer patients. So for neurologists to be involved as early as possible in the diagnosis of neurological complications may help to better define the assessments that are necessary to reach diagnosis, their timing, and their sequence. And this could optimize the use of time and resources, considering that some of these conditions are life-threatening or time-sensitive. And this really underscores the importance to work together with oncologists to really optimize the diagnostic flow. Neurologists might also help to estimate the functional outcome of a patient developing a neurological complication and also estimate the risk of relapse. And this could enable oncologists to modulate anti-cancer treatments accordingly. Well, personally, I really advocate for an increasing involvement of neurologists in multidisciplinary tumor boards. They will become with time fully integrated in the medical team responsible for the care of cancer patients. Nowadays, cancer patients live longer, and we should also maximize all our efforts to make them live better.
Yeah, thank you very much. I completely agree with the key message that you provided us. In fact, really, neurologists should be involved early, and it is highly important to collaborate with the other physician involved in the patient with cancer, and specifically with the oncologist. This is true for the general approach, but also for the management of new treatment that we are now using, such as, let's say, immunotherapy with immune checkpoint inhibitors, but also, I must say, in the care of patients developing paraneoplastic neurological syndromes that we know often antedate the diagnosis of cancer. So I'm really happy and thankful to Professor Berzero for this very nice overview. And thanks also to the EAN for dedicating the theme of the November issue of the podcast to neuro-oncology. Thank you very much.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.